Okay.
Yeah, well, I was just going to come off the farm and come into Winnipeg and joined in up from the Army. I joined the 70th Fuel Battery. And we went to Shiloh that afternoon. We was in Shiloh for, about 2 to 3 months. And they brought a draft into Winnipeg to stay at Fort Osborne to take up a motor transport course. We were in Fort Osborne for a while, then they shipped us back out to Port. He says we hadn't got small arms training yet, or basic training. So we went out to Port and came back into Winnipeg. We stayed around Winnipeg, waiting to get into the school, and the cold weather was coming. We was doing guard duty on a lot of the bridges. And it was getting pretty cold when the Grenadiers came back from Jamaica. We decided that it might be a good go. So they told us they were going to British Columbia for the winter. We was going to train there. Then they'd be going overseas. And this was going to work out pretty good, at least to be out of the cold weather. So out of the 40 of us, I think there was about 2 or 3 that didn't transfer. So we got our leave and went home and come back. Went down to the Robinson building, got new equipment, supposed to have been new equipment. Then the next morning we piled onto the 2 trains that went west, thinking we were going to Vancouver or Victoria. First thing we knew, we got in there and pulled off the train and onto the boat. Well, it started quite a commotion on the boat about that time, because some of them thought that they should have been pulled into barracks. We were told the barracks had been quarantined, so we were taking one of the British Columbia Regiment's place. And on the way out to the coast, I think there was 2 or 3 that jumped the train at Banff, got off, and come back. They came back to Winnipeg. But anyway, when we got on the boat that night, little trouble started. So they took the boat away out into the bay and kept us there for the night. Next morning we started off on the trip, not knowing where we're going. We didn't know nothing. We was training on the boat. As more training was given on trench mortars and such likes. About 2 weeks after we had been out, 10 days to 2 weeks, so we were told that we better equip ourselves, we might have to fight to get off the boat. Then they told us we were going to a western port. At that time, I didn't know whether Singapore or Hong Kong. We finally came out, it was Hong Kong. We landed in Hong Kong, got off the boat, and went up to Champshapo Barracks. And we stayed there. It was a kind of a nice place. I think if things had been right, we could have had a very enjoyable time there. But the way it went, things started to get in trouble with the Japanese up on the top. We had no soldiers of ours up there. The British had troops. And I think that garrison was about 16 miles up. And the British was keeping garrison duty along the line. And one morning, a Sunday morning, we were told to come out fully dressed, all the gear, we're going over to the island. We'd done this several times, this is practice duty, thought it was another practice. We took up our positions up on the island. I was in 4-1 Shy Gap, I was with headquarters battalion. I was up there and we stayed that night. We was out in the morning about 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, and there's 2 or 3 of us, and we seen some planes coming over from the tip of the mainland. Well, we got quite excited about this because we'd heard that there was a fleet of Australians coming in. First thing we knew, they started dropping bombs in along the docks, blowing the docks up on us. Well, this is just where it began. We didn't actually know who it was. We figured that it must be Japanese, but we hadn't gotten all of us out, and then we found out war had been declared. So the next morning, we started out early, way before daylight, issued 10 rounds of ammunition apiece to go down into Happy Valley to meet the Japs coming up. So we were very fortunate. We landed on the edge of this big ravine, cut-in road. We were getting shelled, and we was getting bullets fired at us. And I still couldn't realize we were scrapping. This didn't seem natural because everything had been so normal before. But then it went on and it got worse. They shelled us from the mainland. And when they broke through in us, they come across on the mainland, onto the island with us. They're getting close, pushing us back. We were working night and day. At night we'd be putting up barbed wire fences. Daytime we'd be trying to move stuff back or scrapping. Until the last 3 days, and then it really, really got rough on us. So the day that it was on Christmas, a day before Christmas there, when they capitulated, we was up. Another bunch of us was up on this hill on an old house. Word come in that it was all over. So I was taken, go down to the main road. They're going to meet, going up to Peak Mansions. So we went up to Peak Mansions, destroyed our ammunition, destroyed our rifles, whatever we had. They're still equipped, I'll bet you it's full of rifles and machine guns. And we went up there, we laid around up there for about 3 or 4 days. And they brought us down to the University of Hong Kong. We stayed there for all 1 day. Then down to North Point. We had North Point for quite some time. Then they went back to Kowloon. And I got back to Kowloon and they started work parties going out to Kai Tak Airport. After they got out to Kai Tak, we used to get up early in the morning. You'd never seen the camp in the daylight. They were cutting down a hill, trying to make the runway longer on this one. Then on Christmas, on the first Christmas, after we were taken prisoner, it was quite an enjoyable Christmas, actually. There was no mail from home. We knew that there was no mail had gone out. But the Red Cross had got stuff in there. They'd give us 5 yen. We could go to the canteen and buy little odds and ends. I remember another lad and I, Stan Edgar, we went over and we got 2 eggs apiece. We took a tin of bacon. We had old hot plates made that we used to make out of the slates of the roof, plug them in on the outlets. Finally, the outlets got so loaded that we were blowing the main fuses, so the British engineers went over and put barbed wire in the fuses to carry the currents through. But we was all ready to have a good breakfast when they took us aside they were going to have to call us out of roll call. And we was just to be able to say that we had bacon and eggs on Christmas morning in Hong Kong. That was what the story was going to be. But when we come back, somebody had took our bacon and eggs. We didn't have them in the end. Then after in January, I think it was, they took 500 of us up to Japan. And they went down the row, picked this one, that one, they thought could get along pretty good. I had pellagra throat, pretty bad. That was okay, we'd go anyway. Somebody said, well, you get up there, you're going to live better. So we got away on the boat. The boat was so crowded, the holds were full of us, and so many of them had dysentery. And it was an awful mess to be in. That lasted for 3 days and 3 nights. Then we got off the boat and on the docks, lined up and got on the train and went to Tokyo. Went up to Tokyo and we took in and got into 3D, a camp called 3D, and started working on the shipyards. And we were fed much better then. They were getting a little better staple food. It was rice and or barley instead of rice.
What kind of food did you get when you were back in Hong Kong, was it?
Just rice. And for the first month or 2 months, it was 2 meals a day. And it was cooked in gasoline barrels with the tops cut out. And then they brought in some little wee pigs that weighed about 30 pounds apiece, and they butchered them and threw them in. That made us all sick because they were so greasy, you know. Mm. But anyway, after we got up to Japan, that barley seemed to be quite a bit better. And we also got away from the dysentery. But then we ran into beriberi. And you'd be working, you feel yourself getting heavier, your legs getting heavier. And then you swell up. I used to weigh around about 119 pounds. I woke up one morning weighing about 170. I swelled up. I couldn't close my hands, couldn't close my eyes. Feet were all swelled. Then they took you over and give you a needle and within 24 hours that was gone again. But then we went to Aomori. 50 of us went to Aomori camp, a little island in Tokyo Bay, from there. And we worked in the yards unloading boxcars. Apparently they used to bring the boxcars down and bring trucks and unload it into the trucks, and then it was taken away to go-downs, what they call go-downs. It was big storage bins. And actually we fed fairly well in there because we was able to steal a little bit of sugar and a little bit of flour and little beans, and they had a system that they had a hole in the floor, and they had one of our own men there, they called him a toban, he was the cook. If you stole something, you were able to cook it for yourself. So we didn't do too bad there. Then when in 1943, when the Americans come over, they bombed about two-thirds of Tokyo out one night. And we had a contract. They had a contract to take us to our work, but the buses came for us, and we went through the streets of Tokyo that morning. And there were still patches of tar burning, buildings all burning, wrecks, and everything was wrecked. Women, kids along the street, dead. Some of them burnt, their clothes had been burnt. It was a horrible mess. And I'll never forget it. We used to take our little binder boxes to work. When we was coming home, we had no more work left. It was gone. We was coming home. This colored gentleman was sitting there, and he opened the bus window. He took his bento box and he threw it to an old woman and a kid. He said, they need it worse than I do. And then we come back to 3D, and we stayed there about a week. And then they shipped about 500 of us from there up to northern Japan into Sendai. And I'd been working welding, and I was welding, and I started welding in the shops. A lot of the others were working in the mines, and it was horrible in there. Wet, every night coming home wet, clothes wouldn't dry. So, the lice, it was pitiful. We were well off ourselves. We had forages there. We used to take our work uniforms, throw them in a bucket, and boil them over in the forage. Bring them out, take them home, then put our army uniforms in the next morning, or pants, whatever we had salvaged, do them and wear the company clothes. Let's keep changing. We could keep ourselves fairly free of lice. But the poor guys working in the mines, they had no chance like this. Then when we went up into that mines, we told them up there that we'd been bombed out in Tokyo, and they wouldn't believe us. There was 50 Americans in that camp. Been in there for 18 months. They wouldn't believe us. They'd been bombed out of Tokyo. So whenever we talked to the Japanese workmen, oh, where'd you come from, Tokyo? What's it like down there bombed? No, it couldn't bomb. Can't be bombed. But then we stuck it there then till August of this. No, July. It'd be about July. When the first planes come up there. And blew up the railroad bridges where they used to haul the ore down for smelting. Blew that up, blew some of their smelters out. Well, I began to realize that there was trouble at home. Then they come in day before it all finished. I was taken off a work party because I got Chinese foot rot. Up in the mines, in the mills, we used to weld up in the mills, and our footwear was very poor, and I got this. It's kind of an acid that comes out of metal. I got in between the toes, and I started eating that in between the toes. And I was kept off work probably that day. And our hospital and the Japanese guardhouse were side by side. And I had to go over and wash my feet in this proper manner. And the day before the war finished, the Americans moved in and they bombed Kamishi, Shell Kamishi. And a bunch of Americans working in there. They brought up 26 to our hospital. We had a fairly little, nice little hospital. No supplies, but a little hospital. And I was in the guardhouse, in the hospital, bathing my feet, and I heard the speech from their premier that they had capitulated. And I went to the camp, and I told Captain Reed, the doctor, and I asked him to come over and listen, because I could misinterpret it too. I could understand enough Japanese to be able to make out the speech. So he came over, which he could speak Japanese very well, and he said, yes. He said, we won't say nothing about this. We'll see what happens today. Then about 1 o'clock, all the work party started coming in. And all the next day, by golly, there was beef come in there, there was butter came in. We wondered where it all came from. And they were starting to live pretty good. The Americans came in and they dropped a big Navy bags, medical supplies, food, cigarettes, clothing. Pretty soon they come over with the big bombers and they were dropping in supplies in 2 45-gallon drums welded together on chutes. Figured you're doing all right then. Then when they evacuated, there was 4 of us stayed behind with these Americans because they were burnt so badly. And we had medical supplies then. We got morphine in, which is a terrific help because these burns are so sore on them. And they have to be changed, the dressings. The older system we had, we just took them up, changed the dressing, try to keep them cool. That's what I used to do, stand there and fan them while the doctor was doing dressings, because they were burnt from the waist up. Some of them, their ears are even burnt off. And out of the bunch, we lost one of them. He died. But we stayed with them then for a whole month, pretty near a month. Then the hospital ship come in. They came up with their ambulances. And that was the first we ever seen the Americans. And then we got on the hospital ship, put our patients on. We got cleaned up, got Navy uniforms, and then we got onto a Corvette. We come down to Tokyo on this Corvette. And they stayed in Tokyo for 2 days. We never got on land, just on the ship. Then we went to the USS Hyde troop ship, and then from there to Guam. We was in Guam 5 days coming home. Then from Guam to San Francisco, and from San Francisco to Victoria. And I was in Victoria for about 10 days before I came home. But there's only 3 of us come home on the train together from Victoria back to Winnipeg. My parents had come in from Laurier. So they met me here. And when I was in Victoria, they wanted me to go to the hospital because my feet were all swelled. I swelled up and I said, well, can't I go to geology? Oh, yeah. Well, I never even stopped. I went straight out to the farm. So, but I do believe that it has affected us in ways. The doctors, one of the doctors told me that they experimented on rats. And they fed them the same kind of a diet, a very poor diet. And said he got the same results as we've got. He says some came home blind, some was crippled, some had different things. He said just the same as what the boys had come home with were affected these rats. What they couldn't understand is if this ration was making some blind, why weren't they all blind? Or why weren't they all crippled? And he told me, he said, it worked on the same on rats. So I do believe it has affected us in a lot of ways.
Do you think the Canadian government has treated you fairly since 1945?
Myself, I do believe that they have done fairly well. Like this last 4 years, you might say. But before that, I never got a pension for... Oh, I was out about 8 years, I guess, before I got a pension. And I got 5% just out of it. And I had a broken eardrum, which automatically called for pension. But I was on the farm, and I didn't know enough about the pension commission. And so, and vitaminosis, which was entitled to 10% at that time. And all I was getting was 5%, and then it increased to 10, then 20. And then when... they got this ruling through that every veteran was to get a 50% pension. Well, then I got raised to a 50. And now I had a reboard here last year at Christmas, and I got an increase of another 10%. So I think myself it is. I look around at some of our boys, and there's some of the other boys come from the other side. Is this as bad a shape? It's maybe worse off than some of us are. But there are some of our boys in bad shape. There's a lot of them died. But it's so what? said, that's quite a few years ago since this happened.
When you were in the prison camp, how did the guards treat you? Did they ever beat you up? Or?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I got a couple of lickings. I got a licking from the interpreter at a Maury. He was what we call the bird, Wakanabe. He was very cruel. It used to be when you stepped outside your hut, and his administration hut was across the end of the two huts. You stepped out of your hut and you didn't salute that window. It didn't matter whether he was there or not. You got a licking for it. And then, there was a big parade one day coming off. I knew about it, but I just didn't jump to attention when he shouted attention, and I got a licking for that. But one of the guys, when he was up in northern Japan, he had a kind of a walk going up from the camp to the kitchen. And on the side, he had a bunch of the pigs in it. And I don't know if the same here were going to do with the pigs, whether they were feeding them off our rations or what, but there's an idea that a ruling come out that you couldn't go from the house to the washroom without a greatcoat and a cap. And gee, I got up and I couldn't find my hat, so I out up to the washroom and I got caught with this little scruffy guard. You know, he's a little fella, I could have ate him myself. He caught me. He made me jump in and out with this dashed old pig with all her little ones. And I was jumping in. Every time I jumped in, the old pig was getting crosser, and it let me out and it'd make me jump in again. Finally, the last time I jumped out, and I down the path, into the hut, and up the walk, and on the top. So he said, when I was running, he says, Bungo. So I says, John Joachimichi. Next morning, when they called the roll call, he was running around, Young Joachimichi. Sergeant Major says, hell, he said he's been dead for a month. some of them just know that in some camps that there were, I know I've talked to a lot of the boys, they were very severe. And it amounted to, every so often they used to change guard. Because actually, sometimes we got very friendly with the guards. And one especially, we used to have a little sergeant when I was in the Bournemouth Hospital in Hong Kong. In the hospital there for a while. We used to go and visit him at night. He was on night duty, Stan Edgar and I. He'd let us creep outside with a big fig tree and have a good feed of figs. He'd give us cigarettes. In fact, when the boys tried to escape from North Point, we knew about that before the bunch in camp knew that they were caught. He told us they'd been caught trying to escape over to the mainland, and they were up in Stanley Prison. So I said, what's going to happen to her now? He said, like, you get shot. And that's what did happen to her. But the Japanese left them go down at camp. How every morning the count was coming out right. Every night the count was coming out right. The officers had it arranged. They used to say, there's so many on parade, so many on sick, so many working in the kitchen, so many here. Then they'd total them all up, and then they'd come out right. And they were covering up for him. Then all of a sudden they dropped the boom, and they said, where is Mr. Where's so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so? We want him now. Well, they didn't have him because they had escaped. Then they cut the rations off down to about half rations. And we knew that. He told us that their boys had escaped and they got caught. They went trying to get across on a sandpan. And they got caught crossing into the mainland on a sandpan.
Was there anybody at all escaped out of the camp?
There was six Limeys got out right at the beginning. But I read an account of them that there was only two ever reached the destination. They were heading for Burma. And there's only two that ever got there. The rest of them died. But as soon as it capitulated, they struck off. They knew the country. They'd been stationed in there for years, you know. And they knew the Chinese lingo. They could speak the Chinese lingo. But a sickness took them along the way, and there was only two that got into Burma to the British troops in Burma. But the Canadians had left, they never even got across the channel. 3 miles of water. They never even got across. They got picked up before they got across. And they had connections with the work party out at Kai Tak, some Hindus. They were supposed to meet these Hindus. Now, whether it was... See, the Hindus let us down very badly. And whether it was just a gimmick to see if they would try it, and they knew very well they would get caught. lost or what, I don't know.
During all the time that you were in the prison camp, did you have any kind of entertainment, or what did you do in your spare time, or did you have any?
Entertainment. Your entertainment was your own. This first Christmas that we had, we were with these Limeys, and they put on a real Christmas party. It was quite amazing. I don't know where they got all the stuff from, but they were dressed up like girls, and they sang and they played games. You know what I mean? They acted, some terrific actors among them, singers, and instruments. Our band, our Grandier band, salvaged most of their instruments. And the British units that was there had their own instruments, their own bands. And that evening, we had the Japanese guards and the camp commandant and all sitting in there, and they were really enjoying the whole thing, you know. But that is the only actual entertainment that we had that was, you know, in that style. Now, up in Japan, every once in a while they put a sports day on. They call it a sports day. And all it was to show their people and how our people, they maybe get you throwing this pitch ball. So they'd bring in good people that are good at it, and then the Canadians couldn't do as good, you know. And this is the idea of it, seemed to be. But even fencing, they brought, used to have a wooden gun with a big ball on the end of it and give you a mask to put on and a pad, and then they'd have Japanese soldiers fencing with you. Well, we never did no damn fencing. They've come to bandit fight, and we could show them how to bandit fight. So, but anyway, they got this British sergeant up with the Japanese sergeant. The Japanese, they don't have a butt stroke when they're in a bandit fighting. They just have a pouch. And this pretty sergeant jarred around with him for a while and then come up with a butt stroke and caught him under the jaw and this offended him like a 10-pin. Camp Commandant says, no more, no more of that. That's not good, that's not good. Well, this is what they didn't want their people to see.
And just as a final question, what are your thoughts on war? Do you think it's necessary, or what are your thoughts on it?
It's not necessary, but let's put it this way. If you want a democracy, you got to keep it. You aren't going to keep it if you aren't going to stand up for it. Mm-hmm. If we'd have had, if we had nothing would have happened and Hitler would have run Europe like he was figuring on running it, a bunch of us, or even our children, would have never seen this world. Because there was even effects of it starting to show up in here already. They had people organized in Canada here to start taking over big industry, to take over German immigrants that came out. And I know of one case where one farmer made an awful lot of money over this. He used to get his money from San Francisco, and he was supposed to buy land up in this north country for young Germans to immigrate out here after the war, start taking up farming. But he pocketed the money, he'd come out all right himself on it. But in this case, yes, I think it is quite necessary. If we're going to keep a democracy, we got to fight for it.
And how do you feel about Japanese people today?
I like them. Oh, yeah. When I was working up in the mines, our foreman, he's been a pilot at Singapore when they sunk the Prince of Wales in Singapore. And he got wounded there too badly, so they made him a boss over us. There's just two of us, an American and I, we worked with him. And when we used to go down to the chutes, which is about 4 miles, the well down there, we used to stop at his little house on the side of the road. And his wife took us in, and we used to have tea and give us smokes. Showed us pictures of him in the Air Force, you know, Japanese Air Force. And the sailors were terrific. The Japanese sailors. Every time when he was in Tokyo working on the ships and worked on a ship and got in connection to the sailors, the first thing they wanted to know if you had a cigarette, or you wanted a smoke, or would you like something to eat. They'd give us cigarettes, and then as soon as we got down on the dock, we'd come back onto the army. Well, then the army would try to take the cigarettes off us. Yeah. No, I like the Japanese people. After the war, they were really they're really good with us, you know. Because we stayed in there for so long and lived right in a little town. And we had quite a bit to do with them, and they were very nice to us. But the military rule was so strong there that they would get a licking for the least little... If they showed any little thing that they kind of appreciated you, and the guards caught them, they got a licking for it. Even when you were working with them, they wanted you to have a cigarette. Some of them were scared to hand it to you, so they'd lay it down and look at you and then walk away, and you were going to pick it up. No, the people was good. It was, the army was from the lowest class of people they could get. Their educated people was in the Navy or the Air Force. And the Navy, all their ships in the Navy, even their little sailing logs, is all made out in English. We could go into any part of the pattern room and draw any piece of a pattern that we wanted for that ship. It was all made out in English. And they spoke English fluently. I remember when we were getting out of Hong Kong, one of the Japanese sailors laying in his bunk, and he asked me if I had any smokes. I had me stop by his door, and I said, no, we never had smokes if they asked us. I said, no. So he handed me a pack of their issue. And the guard, the army guard, no, we never had smokes if they asked us. I said, no. So he handed me a pack of their issue. And the army guard seen it, and he come down and take it off me, and the sailor got off his bunk, and they had an awful argument. I kept my cigarettes, and away he went. And I said to the sailor, I said, what did you tell him? So I told him, when he's on the land, he tells me what to do, but when he's on my ship, I tell him what to do. So this is the way they operate.
I was going to ask, when you came back to the States, how did the Americans treat you from the first time that they liberated you until you got back to Canada?
Oh, beautiful.
Did they treat you well?
Oh, yeah. Everything. We had the best of everything. Even on the little Corvette, when we come down from the north, they were short of supplies because they'd been out, you know. Mm-hmm. They made sure we got it. We got what we wanted. They told us there were short of supplies. But on the ship, I worked on the USS Hyde. Down in the galley, all the way from Tokyo to Guam. The same as one of the cooks, an 8-hour shift. Huh? But they were terrific with us. Mm-hmm. They'd be placed out of bounds, you know. And we were dressed the same as they were, blue shirts, blue denims, and a white cap. And you'd see a rope across out of bounds to all ranks. We'd hit through the rope and the sergeant said, hey, come back here, we're POWs. Okay, carry on. No, they were good with us.